Excellent. So our session this afternoon, as always, is a standalone discussion, but it does relate to two prior discussions that we have, and I'll just mention them briefly. The first one is the discussion that we had around Rosh Hashanah, talking about the Jewish calendar. So this is the second half of that idea. Then we spoke about the calendar more generally, and today we're going to talk about a specific calendar issue. So it relates to that. And then last year, we had a discussion about the Vad HaHatzalah and efforts to rescue Jews, specifically rabbis and yeshivas, from the war. And so we're going to reflect a little bit on that. We're not going to rehash it, but there's a lot more to say about that than the book by Effie Zuroff for those who are interested. I want to change the format a little bit today because there is an idea that I felt that it would be worthwhile to share. So even though usually we do not begin these sessions with a Dvar Torah, but today we will, because it's Hanukkah, and there is a remarkable confluence when it comes to the story of Hanukkah and the story of the Torah reading. Every year, invariably, this period of time, we either read the portion of Parshas Miketz, which is what we read this coming Shabbos, or we include what we had last Shabbos, which was Parshas Vayeshev. Always, Hanukkah involves the story of Yosef. And this is an interesting story for us to reflect on in the following sense. Joseph has to endure arguably the most humiliating and degrading type of human experience. He's sold into servitude. Obviously, it's very unpleasant to be sold into servitude by your brothers. But the fact that he's sold is the most dehumanizing experience because he's being commodified. And there is a tradition, according to the Jewish tradition, the rabbis learned that Yosef was sold for a pair of shoes, basing it off of a verse that describes there was a poor person who was sold, Evyon ba'avur na'alayim. And that insight, I think, is also reinforcing the same concept. Why is it that he was sold for a pair of shoes? So, for example, in the morning, when a person recites the morning blessings, in the times of the Talmud, they would recite them successively. When you woke up, you would recite the blessing of opening our eyes. When you stand up, you recite the blessing of standing up straight. Well, there is one blessing that says, Sha'asali kol tzarki, that takes care of all the things that I'm going to need today. And the Talmud says that refers to your shoes. Because shoes are a means of accomplishing something in this world. It refers to the physical world in which we live. And so, if you want to think about, well, what are my physical needs? What are the things that I'm going to need? How am I going to get them? I need a pair of shoes. And to contrast that, when Moses stood at the burning bush, what was he told? To remove his shoes. And a Kohen, a priest who would serve in the temple, would not wear shoes because the sensitivity to the place of holiness is blocked by something that is very base. And the fact that the shoes, you know, I don't have that many pairs of shoes. Some people in my house have more pairs of shoes than I do. So shoes, yes, they can be a fashion statement. I'm not getting into this. They could be a fashion statement, but really the function of shoes are to keep our feet from getting dirty and from getting cut up. And the lowest part of the body is the foot. And so on a spiritual level, our mind, our head, and our heart, they represent the ideal, the upper, and our feet, that's what takes care of the base level.
It's earthbound.
Yes. So how did the brothers treat Yosef? They sold him for a pair of shoes. Meaning, you are the lowest of the low. You are a commodity that we're going to sell. And not only we're going to sell you for something that represents the lowest, the most base elements. the most physical base elements of life. So how did Yosef endure this kind of humiliating experience? So I wonder if the key to understanding this story is a passage that appears in the Talmud at the end of the first chapter of Maseches Megillah, of Tractate Megillah. Because at the end of the arc of the Yosef story, the brothers have some kind of reconciliation. It's not clear exactly how that reconciliation goes, but there's some extent to which the brothers obviously have profound remorse for what they did. They make that very clear. And Yosef tells them everything is okay. So the Talmud tries to dramatize for us what that conversation looked like. How did the brothers feel when Yosef told them, don't worry, everything is okay? So the Talmud has this expression. It says, Yosef said to them, look, chevra, 10 candles could not extinguish, 10 neros could not extinguish one ner. How could it be that one ner is going to extinguish 10 neros? Your 10 brothers, because Benjamin is out of it. He was a child. He was not even 10 years old at that time when Yosef was sold. He says, you 10 tried to put me under and you didn't succeed. Is it possible that I should be able to vanquish you? That's the give and take, which is a complicated argument. I'm not sure it makes them feel totally at ease. But what's the takeaway that I'm hearing the rabbis are teaching me? What Yosef says is that it's true that if I would have looked at life, that my life was the same thing as a pair of shoes, so then I would never have survived. I would have given up. But I don't view myself as a shoe. I view myself as a nair, as a light. And a light is indestructible. You cannot destroy light. That's impossible. A light is a davar pnimi. It's something that is internal. It is intangible. And so what Yosef is saying to them is that, yes, maybe you can crush somebody on the outside, but on the inside, you can never take away the light that lives within. That's a suggestion. Now, if you want to apply it to Hanukkah, you could certainly think about how it's very interesting that when the Talmud describes that when the Chashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, entered into the temple, they had to do something very unusual because everything was defiled. So they had to deconstruct the altar. They had to take all the stones of the altar and put them in an office and rebuild the altar. They also had to transform and purify the menorah because that had been defiled, but they couldn't do that right away. So you know what they did? They took a bunch of spears. There are two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion is they took wood. The other opinion is they took spears, metal spears, because that's what they were military men, priests who were military men, and they fashioned them together in the shape of a menorah. So I think to myself, okay, so if I were an observer in this scene, I would say that's pretty interesting. God, as we know, is omnipotent. So he makes a miracle with the oil, and the miracle of the oil is amazing, and it's sitting in the oil. The miraculous oil is sitting in a makeshift children's, you know, play menorah out of Legos. Isn't that so odd? There's no miracle in the menorah. There's only a miracle in the light, that the light continues to burn. But I wonder if it's reinforcing the same point, that the outside, it may be battered, it may be worn. It may not look, you know, when you're finished, by the time the Greeks and the Jews were finished with everything, it didn't look like everything was pristine. But that's not the message. That's not what matters. The ore, the light on the inside. So God was telling them, you can make a makeshift menorah because tomorrow you can rebuild the menorah. You can fix it. You can make it beautiful again. But that's all transient. That's all temporary. What really matters, the miracle happens on the inside with the light. And you think about the work that you do and the tours that you lead, isn't this one of the key themes that we try to emphasize to the people who come through the museum, that the ability of Germans and their collaborators to destroy can only reach the outside. It can never affect the Nair on the inside. They can make giant piles of shoes and they can do all things to the outside, but the inside, that spiritual core, can never be tarnished. So I think that's one insight into Hanukkah that you could put in your pocket that has to do with the story of Yosef, and that is, I think, reflected in a lot of what we think about when we talk about spiritual resistance and the Viktor Frankl and the inside and what it means to be a spiritual individual. Yeah, Mickey.
I know we usually leave this till the end of the session, but you're speaking and it so reminds me of that photograph we have right in the beginning of the exhibit with the menorah on the windowsill on the inside with the Gestapo headquarters on the outside. And the writing on the back is, you know, death to Judah. The flag says Judah shall live forever. The light answers, and that's what you sent around this morning. But it's a beautiful photograph to kind of introduce that theme that you just...
Right,
because inside and the outside.
Right, what's the crucial element of that theme? It's the light.
Yeah.
It's the light, and that's what they're saying. I think it says the word licht. The licht will never be destroyed.
And Hanukkah is a holiday of the lights.
That's exactly it, and that's why there are even some Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, his opinion was that you don't need a menorah per se. Let's say you're traveling somewhere and you don't have a menorah, you don't have a candelabra to light. No problem. So you go to the store and you get whatever. Tonight's the third night of Hanukkah. So you get three tea lights or you get three candles. You put them on the windowsill and you light them, and that's it. Because it's not the vessel that matters. It's the light. The menorah is not ma'akev. The menorah is the vessel. The vessel is good. But the real point is the light. Okay. That was just a bonus. Now to get to work. Okay. So we're going to talk about one specific episode, which was a terrible, bitter controversy. But this controversy reflects an experience that a specific segment of Jewish refugees in the Holocaust had. And it demonstrates to us the impact, and sometimes we don't think about this, which is why it's important to attend to it, what it meant to try to cling to your spiritual heritage in the circumstance of the Holocaust. Now, we have talked about it at great length, oftentimes from a camp perspective or from a ghetto perspective, but we haven't talked about it so much from a refugee perspective. And that's what we're going to look at one episode today. We're going to focus on a specific date on the calendar, and that was Wednesday, October 1st, 1941. That's the date in question. That's what we're going to focus on. So to get to that date, we're going to appreciate how that controversy has a lot to do with how Jews live their lives today, as we've also done in the past, because this is not just a historical exercise. We actually will find this as a practical matter. So I don't know how many people here have ever had this experience. When I was still single, I went on an educational program to work with high school students in Australia. So that was a very exciting prospect because I had no kids. So who wouldn't want to sit on an airplane for 27 hours with no kids? That was like a no problem. So I had to get from Baltimore to Melbourne. So I had to take a train to New York and then a flight from JFK to San Francisco and then from San Francisco to Sydney and Sydney to Melbourne. By the time you get there, you're totally, as they say in Yiddish, it's a dreit. You know, you totally don't know what day it is. But the reason, there's a good reason why you don't know what day it is. Why not? That's it. Because you've crossed the date line. And this, in contemporary Jewish society, poses a very important question. Because what day it is on your calendar has very significant ramifications in different areas in halacha. For example, why would it be important to know what day it is? Right? What day is Shabbos? What if you are counting the Omer?
Mm. What if you're still in their mourning?
Right? Avelos. A mourning period. What if a woman is counting 7 clean days to get to the mikveh? So many different questions come up. And today, with air travel and the accessibility of air travel, these questions become a significant reality. So this was a question that I had to figure out. Well, what does it mean to observe Shabbos when you cross the date line? Now, this question of how to figure out what is the Jewish date line, according to the Jewish tradition, because the secular date line was an arbitrary line, as we'll see in a little bit. It was just chosen out of a matter of convenience. Well, do we subscribe to that? Do we not subscribe to that? This is an old discussion that dates back 1,000 years, almost 1,000 years, to the period of what we call the Rishonim, the early commentators on the Talmud, because the Talmudic commentators already understood, many of them, that the world is not flat, that the world is round, so that the full disclosure, Nechama does the math and science homework in our house, so we're going to do the best we can. The sun is over here, and then the earth is over here, and then the earth turns around. So when you're at any given spot, that spot keeps moving around, and so then you'll see the sun, and then you won't see the sun because the sun is occluded because it's on the other side of where you are. So if you're over here, and the earth is here, and then the sun is there, so it's going to be nighttime. And if you ever go on one of these long-haul flights, and you watch the interactive map, so sometimes they show you the globe of where it's light and then where it's dark. So in the times that we've shown them, they understood, many of them understood very well that the world is round, and they had to figure out, well, when does the day start and when does the day end at any given place? So that was the origin of that discussion, and that's going to be relevant for figuring out, when I went to Australia, what day is Shabbos, and all these other questions that some people in this room may have had along the way. That's the background. So now let's fast forward. In 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland and the Russians invaded, so as we know, there was a crisis in the Jewish community, and there was a terrible refugee situation that many people were displaced because, as you know, they were running away from different sides, and many yeshivas in the Russian zone traveled to what was at that point still independent Lithuania, and they were under the aegis we've talked about, Rav. That's right, Rav Chaim Ozer Krasinski, who was supervising all of these 2,000 and some yeshiva boys and their Rosh Yeshiva in different places in Lithuania. So of course he was in Vilna, and another very important city was Kovno, which is the capital of Lithuania. And then in this intervening period of months between the outbreak of the war and the summertime, the yeshivas and their students, their talmidim, were trying to figure out what their next move is going to be. So one of the questions that came up was, are they better off staying in Lithuania, or are they better off trying to escape somehow? Well, it turns out, as it came to the spring, and then, of course, in the summer of 1940, the Russians invade Lithuania, and Lithuania is no longer independent. It's now part of Russia, of the Soviet Union. But around that time, there was a group in the Mir Yeshiva who were debating the merits of staying versus going. And it became the majority opinion, through a very complicated story, which we're not going to have time to talk about at length today. Some of this is emphasized. We mentioned this work once before because it's a beautiful summary. This is a secondhand work called, this is the third volume of Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil. So in this volume on rescue, they have a nice overview. This is published by Yad Vashem, a nice overview of this story of the Mir Yeshiva. There's a lot more written about the Mir Yeshiva, obviously, but the experience of the Mir Yeshiva escaping from Lithuania. So the opportunity arose that there was a Dutch colony in the Caribbean called, and I believe this is the correct pronunciation, Curaçao, mm-hmm. Right? Curaçao, is that?
Yeah.
So far, so good. So there were two yeshiva bachrim of Dutch nationality who went to the consulate and said, oh, there's a particular quirk in the law that you don't need an entry visa to get to Curaçao, so could we get passes to leave Lithuania and then get to Curaçao, which is very fine and good, but
Lithuania is over here and Curaçao is over there. So how are they going to get there? Well, they have to transfer through other countries out of the Soviet Union. Well, one way to do that was to take the Trans-Siberian Railroad and transfer through Japan. So there was a man sitting in Kovno, and his name is Sugihara. I'm not going to pronounce his first name because I have no idea. Something like Shimwe, that's how you pronounce it? Okay, we'll go with it. That's whatever Doris says we're going to go with. So Sugihara, his name was Shimwe. He had a nickname. What's that? Senpo, I think. Senpo, I don't know Japanese.
S-E-M-P-O.
Yeah, Senpo. So I assume that's how it's pronounced. So Sugihara is sitting in Kovno, and there is a crowd of people. Here you can actually see, if you can see, this is the outside. This is a picture of the outside of the Japanese consulate in Kovno. People are lined up there, and Sugihara describes how he sees the mixed multitude of people standing outside, and they're begging him for visas. And he decides, and in 1985, just before he died, a year before he died, he is acknowledged by Yad Vashem as righteous among the nations. He decides for no other reason than just the fact that these are human beings and he should try to help them, that he's going to issue them transit visas to Japan, which was against the rules because they didn't have sponsors, they didn't have anybody vouching for them, and they didn't have any real reason to be going to Japan except to get some papers to go to Curaçao, which they didn't end up having. So when they got to Japan, we'll talk about that in a second. But he, on the 11th of August in 1940, started writing visas.
And his wife.
Now there's a machlokus, there's a debate about what the Japanese knew about this and how much they were in agreement, how much they were happy, not happy, but the bottom line is he was a lone man, and you have, from the Holocaust Museum in Washington, you have the two-page printout on the inside of your packet. So he granted over 1,500 transit visas to Jews in August of 1940. Many of these, hundreds of these, were to prominent rabbis and yeshiva boys from the Mir Yeshiva in concert with a group of activists. Now, that was fine to get them to Japan, but how did they had to get visas out of Russia. So there was a very important activist. He was a religious Zionist activist who I met years ago before he died. His name was Zerach Warhaftig. Zerach Warhaftig was... I didn't know that. I don't know that. So he was, my grandfather, Oliver Shalom, was a very active member of the Mizrahi, so he was a friend of his, and I once had the occasion to meet him. So he was very active in coming up with lists and names and reaching out to officials in concert with Rabbi Herzog, who we'll talk about in a little bit, and they actually did get hundreds of exit visas, because, you know, the Soviets were not so interested in people leaving the country. Who wouldn't want to leave our mother Russia? That was not a popular thing to do. But the fact that they were able to get hundreds and hundreds of visas, not everybody got out, because when the Germans invaded in June of 1941, by that time, once the Germans invaded, so then the transit was stopped. So there were people who got visas from Sugihara who did not escape because they couldn't get out of Russia in time. But several thousand people, it's hard to know exactly from what I've read in different places, at least 5,000, maybe 6, some suggest upwards to 10,000 Jews were spared because they were able to get out of Lithuania onto the Trans-Siberian Railroad and to Japan before the Germans entered Lithuania in June of 1941.
I'm somewhat confused. It's my understanding that two countries did not require visas to leave. One was China, the other was Italy, to leave their country. Everybody else needed a visa to get out.
An exit visa, yes.
A visa. In this case, Sugihara was issuing only transit visas.
Correct.
Which is not the same as a
correct
visa, because they had to transgress through the Soviet Union in order to get up to the end point, which was Vladivostok or whatever that
yes
port is called there, and from there they. But at this very moment, the Chinese government or the Japanese government has invaded China,
Right. So one second. So let's. So this. How did they get out of Russia? So there was a.
They
got exit visa. Two different things.
Right.
Right. What you're pointing out, there were two issues. Sugihara issued transit visas through Japan, but there was a Russian ambassador in London. His name was Dr. Elkanon Etkis. Elkanon Etkis. I don't know. I'm sorry. That was a Jewish influencer in Russia, who in London, who met with the Russian ambassador from Moscow in London, together with Zerach Warhafty, who was told by the Russians to prepare a list, and it was the Russians who gave them exit visas. So Sugihara gave them transit visas, but that was only step one. Then they had to go to the Russians and say, we have transit visas from Japan, so we're not going to stay, but you have to let us out. So there was tremendous pressure, and then the Soviets agreed to give them exit visas, two different visas. The transit visas from the Japanese, and then the Russians gave them the exit visas.
Okay. All right, now, that's...
Then they get to Japan. They start traveling over the fall of 1940, up into early 1941, and they settle in Kobe, Japan, where there is the reconstitution of the Mir Yeshiva. Upstairs in the gallery, and I mention this because it's a good stopping point if you want to kind of weave this in at some point. In the rescuer section, there's a small visa that is granted to a man by the name of Mordechai Ginsburg and his wife. I think her name was Sirka, Charka, some Yiddish name. And their little girl, the daughter who's crying in the picture, her name is Esther. I just went to visit her this morning. Her name is Rebbetzin Esther Levin. Her husband just passed away. He was a great, tremendous personality in this community. And so I went to sit with her this morning at their Shiva home. So her picture is upstairs. And their family, her father was one of these young men that was privileged to get on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. They traveled to Kobe. And then when things, as Shail alluded to, things were becoming very tense in Japan because Japan was preparing to enter the war. And so they didn't want all these refugees. So they ended up sending the refugees from Kobe, Japan to China, to Shanghai. Now it happens to be that there were already, from the late 1930s after Kristallnacht, there were already about 20,000 Jewish refugees in Shanghai. By the time the Mir Yeshiva Bachrim got there, there was the whole Jewish community. Now, this was all supported by this, all these visas, tremendous amounts of money. They describe how much they jacked up the price of the, I forget what it was, the number of how much it cost for one ticket on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which took, I think, 2 weeks. They multiplied the price. They had to pay like five times for each person who was going on the railroad. How'd they get this money? So the Vada Hatzala was instrumental in raising funds for this exit strategy. So now we're into end of 1940. People are getting together. 1941, they're settling in Kobe, and then at some point they start to move them along into end of 1941, into 1942, into Shanghai. And so you can look, there are several volumes about this story. That was just the overview al regalachas. Yes?
Also upstairs in the Sugihara exhibit, there's a list of names.
Yes.
And one of them is Isaac Lewin, that we talked.
We talked about him when we talked about the Vada Hatzala.
I just sent you an article written by...
Just this moment?
Yes.
Amazing.
written by his granddaughter, how her grandmother, who was Dutch...
Okay.
...was very instrumental in helping get...
From the Curacao.
Yeah.
In the end of the day, most of these people did not end up in one place, except the Mir Yeshiva stayed mostly together. They ended up splitting at the end of the war. Some of them went to New York and some of them went to Israel. But many of these refugees went to Canada, to the United States, to Israel. Okay. So this is all the background for the next story, the next part of the story. Yes, sure.
So I'm a little lost. I understand what you're saying, but he was in Kovno.
Yes.
Okay, so we have a picture up there where people are lined up in front of his home.
Yes.
You know, trying to get their visas. And
yes.
So, did he help people from afar, or did he help the people right there?
Right there. The people who were there.
Is that a mix? Where did they all come from?
So that's
it.
That's where we started. Exactly. So these people came from all throughout the Eastern area, because you had yeshiva boys, you had over 2,000 yeshiva boys. Some of these yeshivas were in Poland, which had been partitioned. Some of them had been in Ukraine. Some of them had been previously in Lithuania. A lot of these, and they all concentrated in these kind of surrounding communities. The Mir Yeshiva was actually initially, when it was resettled out of Mir into Lithuania, was in three small towns. It was split up. They didn't have a place for everybody. So it was a multitude of different people, refugees, who ended up in Kovno.
Okay, so they came there knowing?
No, they came there. They came there just because they were... Well, a lot of them were in Vilna because Reb Chaim Ozer had said, we're going to support you, and a lot of the yeshiva boys themselves, even if at the outbreak of the war, even if the Rosh Yeshiva were not so inclined to leave their places, a lot of the yeshiva boys themselves said, we have to go. So they heard, it was the word, Reb Chaim Ozer says, we'll set you up, we'll make sure you have a place to eat and some place to sleep in Vilna. So in these communities, in Vilna and Kovno and other small towns, they just had thousands and thousands of refugees. Many of them were yeshiva boys, including this huge group of Talmidim of the Mir Yeshiva, and they weren't the only ones, right? The Rabbi Levin, Zichrono Levracha, his Rabbeim, so they were from the yeshiva from Telz. He was a Telz student in the early years. His Rabbeim were also, if I'm not mistaken, I should check if they were Sugihara recipients, but they also came through Lithuania. The rest of the Telz yeshiva were massacred by the Germans. But Rav Elia Meir Bloch and Rav Mordechai Katz, if I'm not mistaken, they also were just yeshiva rabbis who were fortunate enough to receive visas to get out. But the rest, the Telz yeshiva was all slaughtered except for them. And the Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, who established the yeshiva in Lakewood, so he also got a visa to get out in 1941. He came to America, was very active in the Bar Hatzalah. So now, you ready for this? You're sitting in now in Israel on Friday, September 12th, 1941. You're sitting in Jerusalem, and you get a telegraph. The telegraph is addressed to the rabbis Mishkovsky, Alter. So Mishkovsky, Mishkovsky was the prominent Rosh Yeshiva in I believe it was Kfar Hasidim. Alter is the Ger Rebbe, the Rebbe of the Hasidim of Ger. Herzog, the chief rabbi. Soloveitchik, Rabbi Velvel Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. Finkel, Meltzer of Beit Orenstein, Jerusalem, with an urgent question from 350 Jews begging. Help! Answer immediately regarding which day we shall fast for Yom Kippur. Signed, you don't have this in your packet, signed, Agudas Rabbonim Ubalabatim Mikobi. That was the question. Who had ever dealt with, how many Sfarim, how many rabbis had ever dealt with the question of the international dateline? Almost no one. And see, here you have a whole community of, as they say, Aguras Rabbonim and Balabatim from Kobe, Japan. What should they do? This is the 12th of September. So what did we say? 1941. So what do we say? It's going to be
3 months.
It's going to be very close. We're almost at Yom Kippur. Mm-hmm. It's the end of Elul. So here's the question. What day is Yom Kippur? So if you open your packet...
Not Rosh Hashanah.
No, they're more interested in Yom Kippur. Why?
Fasting.
That's right. You can observe 2 days Yom Kippur, no problem. You can observe 2 days Shabbos, no problem. But Yom Kippur, that's another story. What do you do on Yom Kippur? So this was the halacha l'maaseh shaila that the Mir Yeshiva Bachrim and others sent from Kobe, Japan. So in your packet, the first section is this piece from the Holocaust Museum of Washington on Sugihara. The second, this is just a Ripley's Believe It or Not for your tour.
when you get to Sugihara, you know, sometimes you go to a hotel, and in the hotel they have the little magazine of what's going on in your neighborhood, so they have articles. So apparently, recently, in the Tokyo Weekender, I've never been to Tokyo, and I don't read Japanese, but this is a thing, I guess, if you're a tourist. In September of 2017, they took a poll of who is the greatest Japanese person ever. So I was figuring, face some samurai, somebody who's really awesome, this founder of Toyota, I don't know. Apparently, the greatest Japanese person ever, according to the people that they surveyed in Japan, in Tokyo, for this magazine article, is Chiune Sugihara. Amazing. He's the top. They had 25 people, 25 contestants for the greatest Japanese guy ever. He's number one. So that's awesome. Anyway, that's for you to read later. So go ahead to the next page where you see a telegram. You know, the internet, as we've said so many times, the internet is a terrible curse and it's horrible and it is a lot of awful things. But it is a huge blessing. Look at this. This is the telegram. Dated 28/9/48. So what is that? 41, excuse me. So what is that?
September 28th.
September 28th. Who is it signed by? Chief Rabbi. Who is Chief Rabbi? That's right. Chief Rabbi Herzog. What happens when this Shiloh comes to Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh? A huge brouhaha ensues. This is uncharted territory. There is no clear ruling in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law what to do when you cross the international date line.
So they
did know that existed because they had to observe. They knew already that the earth was round. They had to change the date at some point. So Rav Herzog gathered a group of very prominent Rabbanim, including a great authoritative figure by the name of Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky. Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky is known for several different works that he wrote, including a very important work called Gesher HaChaim, The Bridge of the Living, which is probably the book on the laws of mourning, of Avelos, observance of Shiva, all things regarding end of life. It's called the Gesher HaChaim. He also is responsible for probably the most authoritative calendar in modern times. So Rav Yechiel Michal Tukhachinsky and Rav Herzog and other great rabbis, including the Ger Rebbe, Rav Alter, who was referenced in that telegram, they get together in Yerushalayim and they have a conference. And they go back and forth. A lot of this debates discusses an opinion in a sugya, in a topic in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, which no matter how many times I learned that sugya, I still can't figure it out because it's a lot of math and, you know.
I thought Gesher meant rain.
That's Geshem. This is Gesher. Gimel Shin Reish. Gesher means bridge. So at this conference with all of these Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, they come to the conclusion that you should observe the day of, in Japan, the day of Shabbos on the day that they call Saturday. Which means that on Wednesday, the 10th of Tishrei, which is going to be October 1st, if I'm not mistaken, so then you should observe Yom Kippur on Wednesday. In reply, your cable 12/9, meeting, rabbis, my presidency decided, meaning Rav Herzog, through as office as the chief rabbi, got together a group of rabbonim, fast Wednesday Yom Kippur according to the counting of the days of the week, current in Japan, stop, on my part. I add, none dare risk danger by fasting also Thursday, but should eat that day according Orach Chaim, section 618, paragraph 7 and 8. Chief Rabbi Herzog. Telegram number one. But there was another great rabbinic luminary who's living not so far away in Bnei Brak. His name was the Chazon Ish. He was called the Chazon Ish, Rav Avram Yeshaya Karelitz. He had emigrated to Israel from Lithuania in the 1930s. He was a close protege of Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski. He was a recognized giant in the world of the Torah. And the Chazon Ish, he vehemently opposed this view. And if you look on the next page, this I got from a copy of it. So I'm going to explain it in 1 second. I'm going to give you a map to explain it. This is from an online auction house, which someone paid $12,000 for this piece of paper that you see in front of you on top of the next page, sold at auction. This is the letter, a michtav me'eretz Yisrael. The Chazon Ish wrote a very uncharacteristically strident letter, vehemently opposing the ruling of the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, and telegraphing, sending a telegram to the students that they should observe Yom Kippur on Thursday.
Not Tuesday or Wednesday.
Not Wednesday, but Thursday. And what is the origin of this debate? It comes back to this. So now everybody take one of these. Take it past. So this is a map. You can get a great article where you find this map and a summary of this by a terrific scholar in Baltimore, a rabbi by the name of Rabbi David Heber. He is a calendar expert. He could tell you, you know, based on your birthday, when your birthday is going to fall on a Tuesday, on a leap year. He's a very, very brilliant, detailed person. And they put together, he works for the Star K in Baltimore. He's the rabbi of a shul. It used to be called Rabbi Feldman's shul. Now it's called Rabbi Heber's shul. But he pointed out that he summarized all of these issues, and a lot, it's nogea especially, it's particularly relevant in the world of kashrus, because a lot of rabbis are going to supervise kashrus products in these far-flung locations. So Rav Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky on the purple line, his argument, together with Rav Herzog and others, is that if you see Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, Israel as the center of the world, it's the Merkaz, and he has a publication, if you want to get into the nitty-gritty and the details in Hebrew, you can get it on Hebrew books, of Hayoman, the schedule of the day. He says, well, if Israel is the median, that's the middle point, so then you're going to start the day at what point? Exactly at the opposite side of the globe, 180 degrees opposite Yerushalayim, that's going to be the date line. So that puts, if you see, Israel is on the left side, Yerushalayim line is in the orange. So 180 degrees east of Yerushalayim is going to be right there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You see where the civil international date line is, that's in the black. The nafkamina of this ruling, the practical difference, nafkamina means what comes out of this ruling, is that according to Rav Tukachinsky, according to Rav Herzog, Hawaii, as you can see, is on the quote-unquote wrong side of the date line. Hawaii is on the west side of the date line rather than the east side where it is on the civil date line. The Chazon Ish, basing his explanation on a commentary in Maseches Rosh Hashanah called the Baal Amor, Rav Zrachya Halevi from Provence in the 13th century, he says that the way to schedule the beginning of the day is 90 degrees, meaning 6 hours, one quarter of the 24 hours, east of Yerushalayim. So that's going to be 90 degrees. And you see the blue line that cuts through Russia, China, and most of Australia. So that means, according to the Chazon Ish, that Shabbos should be observed on Sunday. And Yom Kippur, when they said in Japan it's Wednesday, Yom Kippur should be observed on Thursday. Now, what would happen, let's say, Rabbi Heber points out, according to the Chazon Ish, let's say you were walking down Dongfeng Street in Changchun, China.
Let's say
you were doing that. You would find a very odd thing, according to the Chazon Ish. Why? Because you would happen to be in Changchun, China, on Dongfeng Street, you would happen to be exactly where the 90th line meets. So you could have 1 foot on Shabbos and 1 foot on Sunday. So the Chazon Ish says that's not tenable. The rabbis never intended that it should be that somebody should be on one side of Dongfeng, it's Shabbos, and across the street they're cooking. It can't be. The Chazon Ish says, well, what is meant to happen here is that the land mass is judged as a whole. So that means that all of Australia, in the Chazon Ish's view, is going to be gathered toward the west. So too the rest of Asia and Russia, but not Japan, because Japan is an island. So if you are in, according to the Chazon Ish, so let's say, when I was discussing this with my posik, my Rebbe, when I went to Australia, he said, well, if you're in Australia, according to Rav Tukhachinsky, Shabbos is on Saturday. According to the Chazon Ish, Shabbos is on Saturday as long as you stay in Australia. But what if, which was the plan of our group, what if part of the group was going to fly from, I forget whether that day we were in Sydney or in Melbourne, we were going to fly north to Cairns, which is in Queensland, in the north of Australia. Well, Chazon Ish would argue that if you take off on Sunday and you're no longer part of the landmass of Australia, it's very likely that you could now be on Shabbos. You would be on Shabbos. So I didn't. So everybody went ahead on Sunday. I stayed on Sunday in Melbourne. And this way I was able to fulfill both the position of Rabbi Chil Michal Tukhachinsky and the Chazon Ish. Because according to the Chazon Ish, as long as you're still in Australia, Saturday is still Shabbos. Shabbos is Saturday. Does this make sense?
It makes sense, but try to put it together from a layman, from a simple mind, is not easy.
So that's what they're asking the rabbis of Yerushalayim. They're like, what to do about this? Now, there is a third view.
Why wouldn't you just assume if it's Saturday in Australia on the regular calendar, then that's what day it is?
So that is the segue to the third opinion, exactly. That's on the bottom of your page.
That's funny.
He says, exactly, he says, that's what Rav Issa Zalman says. Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer was the co-Rosh Yeshiva of the Kletzker Yeshiva before he came to Israel, and there he founded the yeshiva called Eitz Chaim. He called the yeshiva Eitz Chaim after the Volozhin Yeshiva that was called Eitz Chaim. He was a tremendous gaon. He wrote many svarim. His yeshiva used to be, you could actually visit, I went many times, right behind Machane Yehuda in Yerushalayim, there was an old Eitz Chaim yeshiva building, but I think since then, I think they demolished it and they moved it. But you could go into that yeshiva building. I went from right behind Machane Yehuda in the back of the street. What's that?
I said now it's Judy
Daniels. It might be. So there, right back there was the yeshiva building. That was his yeshiva building. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. And who was the mashgiach of that yeshiva? The ethical supervisor was the Tzaddik Reb Ari Levin. They were like the co-leaders of this yeshiva. It was a very prominent yeshiva. He was a close confidant of Rav Kook. And so he was a little bit younger than Rav Kook. He died, Rav Zalman, Issa Zalman Meltzer, probably died in the late 70s. So he has a different opinion. He says, like Lori says, he says, in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't talk about Shabbos vis-a-vis the international dateline. The Gemara discusses, and this happens sometimes in the Holocaust, let's say a person is lost, and they lose track of time. So the Gemara actually has a debate. What should they do? The Gemara says you should do either one of two things. Either you say today is Shabbos, and you count 6 days, and then you have the next Shabbos. Or you say today is Sunday, and you count 6 days, and then next is Shabbos. But it's, so he writes, and this is in section number 3, you see on the bottom of the section where the, under the Chazon Ish's letter, this is a letter from Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. He says, I also agree to the ruling that was authored in Israel, in Israel, and he quotes others, that you don't change Shabbos in any place in the world, not to Sunday and not to Friday. Because in the Shas, in the Talmud, in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't say anything about how Shabbos relates to the days, the Kavim, the lines of the dateline. It says it has nothing to do with datelines. Ela Ikar, the main thing is, we paskin, you start every day, let's say you were lost, God forbid, every day you start Sunday. Today's Sunday, and then after that is Shabbos. So as long as people are observing Shabbos in that locale, so that is the opinion of Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. So what's amazing, what I wanted to just draw from this tiny little episode, is realizing how these refugees who are sitting in Kobe, Japan, are grappling, number one, with a halachic question, a Jewish law question, that had been unattended for hundreds of years, had never been an issue, and now all of a sudden becomes an issue. And that question is actually the basis of various different practices in our life today. And so what actually happened, the resolution of this story, is that some of the residents in Kobe observed Shabbos on Shabbos, and they observed Yom Kippur on Wednesday. Others followed the Chazon Ish,
who observe it on Thursday. And actually, and this is an amazing testament that talks, you talk about spiritual heroism and what it means to be devoted to your values as a refugee, not talking in the concentration camp, now talking from a refugee standpoint. There were Jews who observed 2 days of Yom Kippur that year. They fasted Wednesday and Thursday because to risk violating what was so dear to them, what was so important to them, they were willing to fast consecutive days to make sure that they knew they weren't going to violate the sanctity of Yom Kippur.
Even though Rabbi Herzog said explicitly not to.
Yes, even though Rabbi Herzog, because they were still, yes, that was Rabbi Herzog's ruling, and he was, but they were torn, because Rabbi Herzog was equally, there's a later, there were several other Sfarim that discussed this at that time. It became a big discussion among rabbis. This was a very heated debate. Rav Herzog was firmly convinced that he was right, that Yom Kippur was Wednesday, and the Chazon Ish, who then actually afterwards published a little treatise on this issue, he was firmly convinced that it was Thursday. So for those students, those people, those Jews who were concerned to make sure that they could wholly observe it to the best of their ability, they were even prepared to fast 2 days of Yom Kippur. And if that's not spiritual resistance, I don't know what is. Right? Think about that. Think about what kind of leniencies they could have said, what they could have, you know, it's just unbelievable. They could have made any excuses. To me, you know, it's amazing that they fasted, but also the fact that this was so important to them, that they were going to send telegrams, they were going to ask. This is what was at the center of their lives. This is their way of continuing the Masorah, the tradition that they had from their parents. And then, of course, the end of the story is that after the war, many of these people, because they had been isolated, they found out what happened to the other members of their yeshiva, to their communities. They found out that everything had been destroyed, and they were the, what they call the She'eris HaPleita, they were the remnants. But this is just one small example. This is one tiny insight into what was a much larger religious period, picture. And you can go online, you can find from Yad Vashem and other places, if you look on the front cover, and with this we'll close, this is a picture from Yad Vashem of Jewish refugees together with some journalists and authors in Kobe, Japan, who are doing what?
Celebrating
Pesach. And this is the same, it's the same story. It's the story of people who are so committed to Yiddishkeit that they are going to do whatever is humanly possible to maintain that tradition. So this is just another calendar experience. Last time we talked about the creation of calendars. Now we're talking about one tiny sliver of a calendar story that reflects this spiritual resistance that they were experiencing. Yes?
Buried in the same section where Chazon Ish is buried.
In Bnei Brak?
In Bnei Brak. My maternal grandmother. We were there. I've been there now.
That's amazing.
To visit that. Once Martin and I went.